What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, episode 92, Psychological Factors Associated with Recovery from Concussion, with Dr. Summer Ott. Dr. Ott was on the podcast a while back when we were first getting started, but she's here at the 13th Annual Memorial Hermann Sports Medicine Update. We want to thank Bob Miley for letting us record the sessions and then interview all the guests. So, Dr. Mark Knobloch and Dr. Josh Yellen from the Masters of Athletic Training program at U of H are doing pretty much all of the interviews, or at least they're doing this one here. And then as we get to the interview part, you'll hear that Dr. Rahul Bajani started the interview because he was just in there hanging out, and then he went to give his talk. So then Dr. Ott just jumped in, and they just kept the interview rolling, and then he comes back and does another interview later to finish up his. So you'll hear from Dr. Summer Ott, and I want to give a shout-out to Chris Shattuck. He asked a question for Dr. Ott through the live stream. If you have questions for us, if you want to contact us, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. Again, always the sportsmedicinebroadcast.com has all the ways to get in touch with us, so you can definitely check it out there. Starting in September again, we should be back up and running with the live events, and they should be CU webinars, so you'll have to sign in there, and it'll keep track of how long you're logged in and everything like that. So we should be back up and running with everything squared away to make sure that your CEUs count for taking part of the Sports Medicine Broadcast. So I am Jeremy for the Sports Medicine Broadcast. Thanks for listening to our interview with Dr. Ott, Dr. Bajani, and then Dr. Ott.
I feel like I need to bust into Britney Spears or something with the headset, yeah, stage. But I won't reenact my show choir days for you just yet. Thanks for having me, Bob, and the athletic trainers at Memorial Hermann. It's always exciting to come every year to do this talk, and hopefully this year it'll be a little bit different in that we're going to focus on psychological aspects of the athlete. This doesn't just pertain to concussion, certainly can pertain to any sort of severe orthopedic injury. Many of your or some of your athletes may have gotten in a car accident, so any of these things are applicable. So I have lots of disclosures, but I'll limit to two disclosures that apply in today's topic, and that would be that I'm a paid consultant for Impact as well as Pearson, and I also received NFL grant-funded money through the NIH for a study that we just recently acquired in a partnership with Baylor. So you've seen this slide before here on the left. we've shown that in the context of concussion because many times we always talk about concussion being an invisible injury, and sometimes Bubba can look the same. We're not sure if he is angry, excited, depressed. So I thought it was pretty fitting how to recognize him as an athletic trainer. So this is what it's like working with teenagers. At times you ask them how they're feeling, of course they say fine. In the context of concussion, they may be otherwise. And to talk about some associated features of psychological distress, it's always very, very important to know your athlete. We talked about that in the course of concussion recovery, but also in terms of mood and their affect. So some athletes and some teenagers in general, the students that you work with are just fairly dysthymic, and they may be like this normally. However, things that you want to look at when an injury happens are things like sad, depression, irritability. Many times, males especially will manifest depressive symptoms and sadness in the form of anger and anger outbursts. So it doesn't necessarily mean that the person, kids won't recognize it either. They'll say, okay, well, I'm just really angry. Well, that is a form of depression in some ways. Poor appetite, decreased energy, discouraged, exaggerated sense of frustration. You ask them to do something, and all of a sudden, it's just things are blowing up. Their response isn't maybe necessarily matching the episode at hand or what happened. There may be lots of interest in physical activity, so normally they would be chomping at the bit to go hang out with their friends, but now they no longer want to do that. Sleep disturbance is pretty prominent, concentration, memory problems, self-defeating statements, and in a few cases, but certainly serious, is suicidal ideation or thoughts of self-harm, a plan or carrying things out. Anxiety can be the difference. You don't have to have both, one or the other, but can happen in combination. And anxiety means things like feeling keyed up, feeling on edge, having some panic-type symptoms. So when you hear an athlete say, I'm having problems breathing, or it feels like I have an elephant on my chest, I just can't regain composure, many times it may not be a cardiac issue. It may very well be a panic response or something. And many times that panic response can happen without a significant or identified trigger. It may happen later on or just maybe due to a thought process. Muscle tension is often prominent. Feeling dizzy, so there's a sense of, okay, I feel dizzy, but now is that concussion or is it psychological in nature? Some other physical manifestations, sweaty palms, feeling nauseous, trembling, and shaking. So some psychological factors here, some psychosocial factors. And historically, we've always thought of concussion following sports-related concussion, and then, psychological distress following sports concussion is being attributed to maybe a loss of scholarship, loss of position on the team, time away from teammates. Many times people treat it, school faculty, but also their teammates, coaches, it's the invisible injury. It's not there, so therefore it's not present. You can't see it. It's not there. Feelings of isolation that can lead to depression, so no longer maybe attending team meetings, attending practices and games, taking road trips to the team, all of those things causing these psychological responses. So that was always what we focused on in terms of people having depression or anxiety post-concussion, and it has to be due to the things that are not related to the team. Anxiety in academics certainly can create a lot of psychological responses. Cognitive rest can increase anxiety. So many times I'll get a phone call and say, well, Dr. Ott, this person is really struggling. Why did you not take them out of school? Well, we really talk about the individual response of every athlete, and in some cases, taking them out of school would be more detrimental given the anxiety they experience and be problematic in the recovery. And so we kind of look at what's the higher ratio here, what's the best ratio to make the person become recover more quickly, and it may be going to school because the anxiety was so high if they didn't. Identity crisis. I'm no longer the person that's the head of the team. I'm not the quarterback. I may be the second string now. My identity's changed. Everyone sees me as the athlete. What else am I? What other contributions do I have? And then conflicting medical advice. So they may go to one physician in here that their prognosis is good. They may go to another physician or specialist and hear something otherwise. There's a lot of turmoil over who is really correct, and then also what is my outcome. And then fear of re-injury. And those are the ones that you see playing timid, perhaps when they are recovered and return back to sport, fear of re-injury at that point, and may not play like themselves, and the coaches are, and or you may observe those things. So some other psychosocial factors are work and school demands. So certainly trying to keep up with the work demands, the school demands when you're not feeling well, and maybe people aren't giving you accommodations that are due to you. Social support, perhaps that's an issue, particularly we're talking about in the college level, it may not be as available as it is in the high school level and younger. Team support, is your team behind you, or are they always asking you when you're coming back, is it a caring means, or is it that they think, or they've interpreted that you're taking too long to recover? And then family support. Pre-injury emotional functioning can also certainly play a role in the response after concussion. When people are looking at why are some athletes taking longer to recover than others, this can be certainly a moderate factor. Individual differences in stress responsiveness. Sometimes it takes the trauma, i.e. the concussion or the injury, to be the one thing that sends an athlete over or a student over the edge, if you will. Perhaps they've always coped fairly well. There may be a family history of emotional disturbance or a propensity towards emotional distress, but then the trauma onsets, and therefore the recovery process is affected. So we often see that too in military. We see it in people that go to the next level in professional sports. Maybe they've not had that level of stress before. When they enter into basic training, it's the biggest stressor they've had. And then we've seen some psychopathology come out, maybe some schizophrenic type symptoms. And someone said, I never would have thought of this before, or would have seen it in this person, and it comes out now due to trauma. So it may have always been there, kind of like a risk factor for any kind of medical illness, but now something brings it about. An ability to cope with that stress or adverse event. For some of these kiddos, this is the worst turmoil they've ever had. They've never had a death in their family. They've never had a parent lose a job, and everything's always been great. And then this happens, and they really just have no coping skills for this event. Personality factors and functional disability after MTBI. Some of the things that when looked at for what make people, in terms of personality, problematic triad or problematic characteristics that prolong recovery. Things such as overachiever, dependent, insecure, grandiose, and borderline personality characteristics. So think of maybe some of the athletes that you've been surprised at the rate of their recovery, and you look back at them and kind of know them as a person, and maybe some of these things apply to that particular athlete. For example, the ones who won't take accommodations. They always continue to push themselves over and over and over until things get worse and finally snap. Dependent, they're often looking to mom or dad to answer questions for them. They can't make their own decisions. We see some of those kinds of characteristics. Insecure, they're afraid of letting someone down. They also don't feel very confident in themselves and their skills. Grandiose, maybe they have really overarching high expectations that aren't necessarily there, and they think that they're immune from having any kind of protracted recovery or long-term issue. And then borderline personality characteristics are individuals who often have a fear of abandonment. They split people in terms of trying to cause problems. Sometimes those things are also characteristics in that they're always maybe splitting their positions and the care that they're getting from the athletic trainer and the physician, and that can be, of course, detrimental to the recovery process. So deficiencies in mood, also looking at some things, some people will present with very depressive type symptoms independent of concussion, and it's important to entertain some other things to the physician running a lab panel, perhaps, to see if there's any deficiencies in things like B12, if there's a thyroid issue, where the person needs to have omega-3s. Hormones is particularly rising in level of interest in research as being something that could be deficient, particularly in females that protract recovery. So one of the grants that I just submitted last week was to look at females the very first time we see them within 7 days of their injury have a hypothalamic hormone panel ran, and seeing if that type of information can help us predict the people that will be recovered within about 7 to 10 days, others that will go on to 1 month and 3 months. So nobody's really looking at those things particularly to see if there's some predictive value in it. And in some traumatic brain injury female patients, there's been found to be deficiency, but many times those people come in and see the physician that does that type of panel within maybe a year post-injury. So we don't know what it looks like initially or very acute. So that's an interesting thing to consider. So pathophysiology of emotional symptoms, injury to the frontal lobe is pretty prominent in terms of emotional symptoms. If somebody has a frontal blow to the head, there may be some poorly regulated behavior, disinhibition, can be aggressive. Again, their responses aren't necessarily congruent with the situation. There's impulsivity, they lack judgment, there's poor judgment, insight may be affected. And those type of things with a very prominent frontal lobe injury or disruption causing these things, certainly when taken into consideration, it may have been the impact of where they were hit. Injuries to the temporal lobe or the sides of the head, looking at flattened affect, probably at reverse where there's not much emotion or much response to things. And to continue on with this in terms of looking at the neuropathology and really looking at the brain function and what may be causing it. So we're not just looking at psychosocial things, but what chemically and what in terms of blood flow disruption could be happening for the concussed athlete that could be contributing to their behaviors. And this is where it's really tough because it's not their fault per se. They don't feel like they can control it. And some of the things that have been looked at is in 56 male athletes looking at a no depression plus concussion group. The concussion group says they have no depression. Looking at a mild depression group with concussion, looking at a moderate depression group, so more significant depression when they were endorsing it plus concussion, and then healthy controls. Looking at outcome measures of the post-concussion symptom inventory from the impact test. The BDI is called the Best Depression Inventory. It's a very really small screener that's often used in research and clinical assessment. MRI and fMRI, functional MRI. And what was found was there's no difference between the groups when they were doing the functional MRI and they were in there doing the working memory aspect in the scanner, having the functional part of the MRI performed. There was no difference there. However, athletes with depression plus concussion did have reduced activation in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex and striatum. So it kind of makes sense. Prefrontal cortex, the pure emotional center, being reduction in blood flow, and then attenuation and deactivation in the medial frontal, some more temporal areas of the brain, which is also more of our limbic system. So those things being affected, showing in terms of blood flow reduction, if the blood flow is not getting there, then of course it's affecting the personality and behavioral components. And then depression severity correlated with the neural activity and the loss of gray matter in these areas. So the higher reported depression, then the reduced gray matter in these areas. Now what wasn't talked about in the study is that do those things recover and do they start to, does the blood start to filtrate through the brain in a way that it did once before the concussion happened, and that's not been studied or examined. So the other thing that hasn't really been examined in terms of concussion post or depression after post-concussion is age, effective age, and gender. Contos in 2012 compared females and males to high school collegiate athletes to kind of get this idea. We've looked at college athletes and high school athletes comparing each other in terms of concussion recovery, but what about with respect to emotional functioning? And the highest level of depression endorsed on the BDI that affects depression inventory and the post-concussion symptom inventory, emotional cluster symptoms within 2 to 7 days. So the highest amount of depression or anxiety and other emotional symptoms reported within that type of time frame, right there, 2 to 7 days. An increased depression score related to depressed reaction time, a lower visual memory score, and a higher post-concussion symptom score. So it kind of makes sense, a positive correlation, that the higher reported depressive symptomatology, the higher the cluster of other post-concussive symptoms. So it's a positive correlation. And then if those looking at 2, 7, and 14 data points. So if you ever go back and examine impact on the post-concussion symptom inventory, and hope you do, obviously you're managing your athlete throughout the process, you use the graded symptom checklist, whatever you're using, and looking at those symptoms, oftentimes that overall symptom score is pretty high as well. And what they found also here is college athletes had a tendency to report greater levels of depression at day 14 when compared to high school athletes. So think about some of the other studies that were performed before that college athletes recovering more quickly than the high school athletes. But for those that aren't recovering quickly and are still symptomatic at day 14, their depression levels are higher than high school athletes. And some of the ideas of this are theoretically competitive level, fear of losing scholarship, better family support system. So I don't know how many times I've seen the college athlete here and the parents are flying in or coming into the appointment to set with the athlete and the parent then saying kind of independently, Dr. Art, I just feel so helpless, I'm so far away and I can't be here, and even though we talk regularly, it's not the same thing as when they're with me. So, and the athlete feels that lack of support too when they're there, it's just not maybe as close in terms of geographical support. There's been no gender effect on this particular study, which is actually contradictory to other TBI studies in which females do have a greater reported affect change or depression post any kind of head injury. And the level of depression at day 2 in this particular study may be predictive of those people that have, if they have a high depression score at that particular point, may somewhat suggest to you later that they may be in a longer protracted group. So interventions are, what can we do? So early education and intervention with an athlete and a family is very effective. So the first visit that I often do, if I get to see them very acutely, is we sit down and talk about what they may expect. And I'm sure some of you do the same thing. We go through and say, every concussion is different. Some people have an emotional, disturbance. Some people have more headaches. And go through those things and try to equip them with some sort of coping strategy. And many times it kind of falls on deaf ears because all they're hearing is, when they go back to play, they're not necessarily wanting to, that's not me, I won't be in that process. But reminding them that this could very well happen. So then, I think in some ways that later if they recover very quickly, that's the time you want to be wrong, of course. Formal psychological evaluation. You can't just suspect these things are going on. Actually referring them to someone that can perform psychological evaluation is important because you really need to know what the etiology is. Is there a lack of family support? Is there some kind of hormonal deficiency? So knowing what that is. And psychotherapy, individual or group, can be very effective for people in this protracted recovery process. I do want to clarify, though, that sports psychology consultants are different from counseling psychologists. Many people don't know what that is, what the change is. So many sports psychologists, many of them may only have master's degrees, they may just be a consultant. And many times they will shy away from doing anything that's crisis intervention, any kind of more severe psychopathology. They will work up with the athlete on the competitive component of things and helping them in terms of maybe visual imagery, helping them get back in the sport per se. But when it comes to, and I've had this happen to me, I've referred them to a sports psychologist and they get really nervous when it comes to more of the depressive side of things and more of the psychopathology, and they will refer them out to a psychologist themselves. So kind of knowing that difference is important. I'd say the sports psychologist would be great, maybe coming in the back end and helping the athlete return back to play if there's some timid feelings of return or fear of re-injury. But in terms of actual suicidal ideation, other types of issues, it may not be the appropriate referral source. Helping people understand the self-talk that they're engaging in. Many times when you're suggesting them, let's go ahead and start getting more physically active, they're nervous about doing that. So they may have their own kind of dialogue going on internally about, I'm not going to be able to handle this. What happens if I fail? So looking at those types of thought processes and helping the athlete identify them, but also to to replace them with more effective thought processes. Also, relaxation training can be very helpful. Another grant that we just submitted is looking at athletes and employing an intervention of mindfulness training, which is meditation training. The athletes always ask me, the parents, what can I do during this period? And they're saying, well, rest. That kind of makes you feel helpless. If we could employ some kind of intervention, or at least working on some of those anxiety symptoms, it may be effective. And in functional MRI studies have been done, mindfulness training and meditation actually have some great types of response patterns in the brain. Pharmacological treatment, antidepressants can be employed. Many times, though, in the teenage population, you want to be very cautious because there can be some pretty bad side effects. Prozac, some of those have been known to increase suicidality in teenagers, so be very careful and maybe doing the behavioral options first. Other interventions here that, you know, we tell people, let's rest, but then sometimes that's kind of a negative consequence then, too, for somebody that rests too long. There can be some other problematic behaviors. So now there's this movement towards Lenny and colleagues. In 2010, there's been a subsequent article more recently where we want to, when is it okay to start employing exercise with our athletes? We know it's good for mood. We know it's good for brain health. We know it's good for so many physical aspects. So when do we do that? And I think, again, everyone's different. We certainly don't exercise people very acutely. But when it starts to get to be 2 and 3 weeks post-injury, I think that we can start to, we sort of incorporate this a bit in our clinic. We're starting to put people in some kind of controlled treadmill exercise program or stationary bike. When we do look at maximum heart rate, what are they able to do in terms of their threshold? And that's a very serial graduated progression back in activity, and that has been helpful in demonstrating through research to show good things. So if you get a response from us, let's go ahead and start stage one, or let's go ahead and do this thing, you can look at us like, well, in the law it says don't begin any kind of activity until they're symptom free. I think these are the examples of things of why everything's individually driven and can be helpful. So we would encourage you to kind of look at this a little bit with your athletes and maybe get them a bit more active. Changes in identity, when we talk about satisfaction post-retirement from athletes, this can be post-retirement, not due to concussion, but due to other factors as well. An athlete's identity was found to decrease as the athlete approached retirement. So for those that were maybe nearing retirement or seeing that they were going to retire, they were much more confident in their identity and able to see themselves in a different light than maybe someone who didn't get a choice or enable a way to control their retirement. Athletes that voluntarily retired reported an increase in life satisfaction post-retirement than those who were forced to retire. Kind of makes sense, kind of a no-brainer here. But I do know in the past few years in working with NFL players, it's always very interesting to see the ones who have a backup plan already established before the injury happened. I've seen them take the injury on much more confidently. And I've seen them be able to say, well, hey, if this is it for me, I've got other things. But the ones that don't have any kind of backup plan or other types of skills they've identified can be very troublesome, as you would imagine. And, you know, that's one of the things we need to work with athletes. And the NFL does do that. And people kind of criticize them, but they do have programs to help them do these things, whether or not the athlete wants to sort of engage in it and believe that they identify their skills as a tough thing. When they've played since they were 3, it's tough to know any other skills. So helping them identify their strengths and interests and support services to adapt to post-life. So it's just like in the military, when they're coming back from deployment, being able to equip them with not only physical types of health and information, but also what do you do now that you're not playing sports anymore? How can we help you to make this a better outcome? I did want to touch on CTE because I think that when a lot of people in terms of, this is because the media, when you hear CTE, you think suicidality, and that's kind of what, you know, CTE has been associated with, I think, with the media portrayed. And when we look at CTE, really only out of the 51 deaths in the published article in 2012 by Ann McKean colleagues, only 7 deaths were from suicide. So it's not as high as it's kind of being portrayed. It's certainly concerning, I don't want to minimize that, but not as high as it's being portrayed in the media. And often what's recognized first by family members of CTE is the emotional things, such as the depression, apathy, impulse control issues, the suicidal behavior, and substance abuse. So CTE, of course, is associated, but it's not the only feature. So I did want to do a quick presentation or a quick little discussion here about an athlete. This is a 19-year-old female collegiate athlete that I've worked with over the past several several months, injured during a soccer game in the early fall, head-to-head contact with another player going up for headers, pretty common scenario here. Removed from play immediately, evaluated by our athletic training staff, no amnesia, loss of consciousness, very mild symptoms. Normal MRI, it was not necessarily because there was any neurological symptoms present, but that particular school doesn't make it fairly customary. After a week or so of no progression, they'll often have the athlete undergo an MRI. Studies didn't impact of initial testing with athletic trainer, but it was really only in reaction time. For pre-injury cognitive performance, I don't necessarily think I have this up here, but it's pretty much above average in most of her areas on the impact test, and the only area that was really deviated at her initial assessment within a few days post-injury was the reaction time. And 3 weeks post-injury, she brought to see me at that point complaining of headache, blurred vision while reading, dizziness, hypersomnia, reduced attention span, and mixing of words and talking. Her neuroexam revealed some mild dizziness and blurred vision while fixated on stationary objects. So when we're having her look at a focal point and she's moving her head from side to side, she's complaining of blurred vision and feeling dizzy. And then we also found a convergence insufficiency. So going and moving a point towards her about 6 to 8 is normal. And when that exceeds that, she's having difficulty with blurred vision. And we're seeing that there's a visual disturbance as well. And it's noteworthy that she was hit the back of her head, so therefore the visual cortex played a role in that aspect. When your athletes show that and you're seeing it when you're evaluating them, sometimes that can be concerning and can be a sign of protracted recovery due to another therapy that we have to send them to for visual tracking that can be quite an issue. Her motor programming was intact. She did have some multiple errors on single leg scans. That one I don't make so much of a big deal about because I see it so often in people that are healthy. But then in terms of tandem scans on a firm surface and then phone, just really committing multiple errors, there's definitely some more things going on with balance. However, her symptom score was like 15 total symptom score. It was pretty low. So really when she came in, I thought this would be pretty simple. She was really complaining of mild symptoms. She wasn't complaining of any emotional symptoms. We're going to get her onto her therapy. She's going to do well. She's going to get a support system. She's with her family. And much to my surprise, this was September, and now we're still going on several months of really no change. So this has been my hardest one to date that I'm sharing with you, and for everyone else involved in her case as well. So interestingly, though, there was a decline in neurocognitive performance over subsequent impact trials. So we maybe tested her once a month, not too much. We did do some paper pencil testing with her as well, and started seeing changes. So with that hypothetically, we start thinking about what are some reasons for this change. And one of the things that comes to mind is maybe emotional issues where there's a change. Because really there should be improvement in many ways because of a practice of that. So she sees my colleague, a PM&R physician. She's put on typical medications that we often give people that are about 2 weeks post-injury with no effective rest. And then she's not doing well on those things, no added benefit. So 2 or 3 different medications are tried. Finally, at that point, my colleague says, I really don't know what else to do with her. We've tried everything that we typically do. So we sent her to a neurologist for another opinion. She got put on some other medications. We even tried taking her off medications. We put her in visual training exercises that are often helpful for helping people retrain when it comes to blurred vision and visual ocular motor stuff. She got so symptomatic that she would be in bed for several days afterward. So we're just like, we don't know what to do here. This is just really abnormal. This is just not working. She's out of school completely at that point. And then she wants to go back, though, for the spring semester so she can keep her scholarship. I advised her not to go because, it didn't really make sense. If you can't be out of bed, how are you going to go to school and take 12 hours? Well, somehow she was able to get 10 hours to where she could still maintain her scholarship. And she did go to all those 10 hours and completed them and made all straight A's, with all of these symptoms. She went to a couple of sessions of counseling. We talked about grief of being out of soccer and some other types of things, reactions to her symptoms. She went to a couple. Her last evaluation, they kind of keeping up with her, with the athletic trainer. She's been seeing my colleague. She's reported that not had 1 second without a headache since my concussion happened in early September. Not 1 second. And so, but everything else is showing improvement on paper pencil testing, showing improvement in terms of her visual ocular motor stuff, but she's still saying not 1 ounce of time if I had without this headache. So the neurologist gets really confrontational with her and starts saying, look, I think you don't want to be better. And then, of course, that spirals downhill because she's not the type of person that you really need to give in. So it has to be her indication I learned about things. She has to come to that conclusion. So I worked with her in a way that we start talking about what are you thinking whenever we talk about exertion. She's saying that I won't do it because I feel symptomatic. We started really talking about what are your interests. I said, do you want to, you know, talking with her mom, does she want to play soccer anymore? Does she really want to play? And she told her mom, this is interesting, I may not want to play soccer, but I want to choose not to play soccer. I don't want to not play soccer because of my injury. So that was a little interesting that in some ways, are you really wanting to play soccer? She's already looking for the next outcome. And then her testing is above average to superior, but then this is the time when I talked her into it. We did do some psych testing, and it came up significantly elevated where we had major depression disorder and somatization. So I couldn't do that earlier, even though I suspected it when we had no response to any of the typical treatments the other athletes respond to. And somatization means that it's an unconscious process where you have psychological distress that manifests itself in the form of physical inability or physical symptoms. So at this point, that's a really tough thing to treat because you have to really get the athlete or the student to buy in that this is really a psychological consequence. And then sometimes you say to yourself, is it the chicken or the egg? Is it, are they at this point because they have felt crappy for so long? So it's really tough. This is the hardest one to date. I haven't had one nearly this protracted, especially where we've done every single thing and multiple people have been involved doing the right thing. This isn't mismanagement. But now working on, okay, what can we do to help her depression symptomatology? After she completed the questionnaire, she called her mom. Her mom shared with me that she said, you know, I marked a lot of stuff on there, and I think I really am lonely, and I think I really am depressed. And so now she's starting to realize it. So maybe moving forward, we'll get a breakthrough here and then have some amelioration of psychological distress. And I really hope, I mean, she doesn't have a serious concussion history, so I think in some ways if we can get that under control, she may be playing soccer again, which if that's what she wants to do, I think that's pretty cool. So in summary here, know your athletes, of course, like you do for any other injury. Recognition of psychological issues following concussion is crucial, so don't let it get out of hand. If it's early on, start talking to the athlete about it, talking to your family members. The athlete should undergo a formal assessment if psychological distress is affected. And athletes that have had for suicidality, they've all been my college athletes. They've been the ones I've been really concerned at and have had to walk across the street and work through the ER to get them admitted, so it can be really scary. Make sure you're always asking those questions because you may be the only person that is. Psychological issues that go untreated certainly can affect recovery. Athletes with retirement issues will require continued support. And the majority of concussions, I really just want to end with this because it sounds all kind of humdrum and, you know, horrible. But really, most concussions do really recover within 7 to 10 days. And we're talking about the outliers here in today's presentation and not necessarily the ones that are always the people that you see. So keep in mind, there's always very good outcomes as well. And here's just our last slide. So we have this brain night. We got to hold some brains. Even my kid that's 4 got to hold a real black brain. So we work brain night, and we got to teach kiddos about brain, so there's our team. And you can see Bubba still got the same expression. Thank you very much.
Hey, how you doing, everybody? This is Dr. Josh Ellen with the Master of Athletic Training Program at the University of Houston. You can look us up at www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT. I'm here again with Dr. Mark Knobloch, who is our clinical coordinator, one of our co-medical directors, Dr. Rahul Bajani. Dr. Bajani, thank you very much for being with us.
You're most welcome.
Dr. Bajani, tell us a little about yourself. Where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to school? Where did you do your residency, your fellowship?
Well, I grew up in Houston, Texas. Born in Houston, Texas, grew up in Dallas, did all my schooling in Dallas, UT Dallas for undergrad, UT Southwestern for med school. Decided happy wife equals happy life, came back down to Houston, did my family medicine residency at Memorial Hermann here in Houston, and went up for my primary care sports medicine fellowship up in Detroit, Michigan. Settled back down in Houston, figured it was a good place to live, and been chugging along ever since. I've got a family medicine, sports medicine practice now coming on to 3 years in Sugar Land, Texas, and just hanging out with you guys now.
Now, we interviewed an orthopedic surgeon not too long ago, Vishal Shah, who I think also went to the same medical school you did.
Yes, he did.
Did you guys, were you in school together?
He was there the year I started school. He had graduated, so I had met him in passing coming up. But he's a local Houstonian also.
Yeah, that's right. So you guys know each other.
We know each other. I got to actually train under him while I was in residency for a couple of years.
How about that? That's pretty neat.
Yeah.
It was common ground.
Yeah, he's a good guy, trained at Andrews. You know, he's
The hip guru.
The hip guru, indeed.
As yeah. they are. So let's talk about a little bit about your background and your training, and let's make a distinction between, the sports medicine field, where everybody, when they think about sports medicine, they only think about a few different specialties. But you are family medicine mm-hmm. with a fellowship in sports medicine.
Correct. So it's a unique field. It's been around for about 20 to 25 years. It's been more prominent in the north. It's starting to make its way down to the southern part of the country. There are about 100 so fellowships now, creating about 140 slots. So not that many people going into it. When most people think about sports medicine, it's all about the orthopedic sports medicine, the arthroscopies, the ACLs, and the shoulders and the elbows. So we do a completely different thing. We do a variety of different facets of medicine. We do, you know, general medical conditions, dermatology. We do non-surgical orthopedics, you know, kind of doing the initial screen to extent, doing all the imaging modalities, doing the injections. We can do the concussion work, which, it's a big important part of sports now. We do exercise physiology, VO2 studies, and whatnot. So there's a lot of different things that us as a specialty bring to the table that might end up creating us as a gatekeeper for sports somewhere down the line.
Sure.
Well, speaking of that, easy to say, what do you not do?
Well, there's plenty of things I don't do, but there's plenty of things I do. We'll leave it at that.
Tremendous asset.
And Jasmine, on the video here, are you able to see Dr. Ott speaking of concussions? So with us that just joined us as a part of our medical team, and again, we're really fortunate to have Dr. Bajani as one of our co-medical directors, and we also have to my right, Dr. Summer Ott, neuropsychologist. Dr. Ott, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Dr. Ott, tell us a little bit about your specialty. I learned something not too long ago that a neuropsychologist has gone through the training to be a psychologist and goes through an extra fellowship. So tell us a little bit more about your specific training and how you got into the field.
My degree is in clinical psychology with a specialization in neuropsychology. So licensed as a clinical psychologist and then did a two-year fellowship. So as Dr. Bajani may have mentioned, fellowship training within his specialty, we also undergo the same type of training in terms of perfecting our craft, if you will. And you can go into different areas. So there is forensic neuropsychology, there's health neuropsychology. I'm sure I'm missing some other fields right now, but and then sports psychology is a new and evolving field within neuropsychology, and that actually was by default. So as an athlete going through high school and playing some post-high school ball, I really felt that as I had this opportunity, it was a good niche for me, being an athlete and understanding and empathizing with athletes as they're injured, and this particular injury being concussion. So really went into the field thinking I'd be a therapist, really didn't want to do that part after I started doing some therapizing and learned that people didn't maybe get better or do the things that I wanted as quickly as I had hoped. So I'm now more of a diagnostician and then also researcher. So how's that long explanation?
That's outstanding. And I think people need to know, right? A lot of people that are listening to us are just getting into the sports medicine field or they're listening to this as continuing education, as we're talking about before. You know, if you're not directly involved in that umbrella, you may not know all the different spokes that happen. So let's talk about the two of you have some overlap, and that overlap is in diagnosis of concussion. The two of you talk a little bit about the clinical relationship that you have and how does this interact? So I'll kind of play this scenario. I'm an athletic trainer on the field. I see a concussion happen. I diagnose it as a, grade 2 concussion, whatever it is. And Dr. Bajani is my team physician. I refer on to Dr. Bajani. Take it from there and take us through the process of the difference between what Dr. Bajani does and what you do as a neuropsychologist.
So I will answer that question in two separate scenarios, because I think the scenarios really play themselves out. The first scenario is the one, Josh, you just so mentioned, that kid comes in, has a concussion. You know, the way we determine, from my standpoint, I'll come in, I'll do my initial evaluation and physical and do the neuropsych testing, the computerized neuropsych testing if needed. If it is a simple concussion, and the word simple is a very vague term, depends on your level of comfort, I can manage it to a certain extent. If there are complicating factors, and Dr. Ott will chime in on this a little bit more, is such as younger age, comorbidities such as ADD, dyslexia, or any other prior history, or that they are having issues with vestibular speech issues, this is where Dr. Ott's expertise comes in much more valuable than my initial assessment. The second scenario is the vice versa scenario, where Dr. Ott is seeing a kid or adult with post-concussive syndrome, for example, and needs my expertise as far as the medication management and bringing the symptomatology scores down, as well as bringing the exercise threshold back while they're still recovering from the injury. So that's where, you know, we play hand in hand. A lot of times we will share patients and discuss how we can make things better. I know Dr. Ott and I just started working on a submaximal symptom threshold exercise protocol that we're going to try to implement here and come up with ways to make the program more advanced and then bring the research part of it in also. So I'm going to let her chime in now on her part.
Well, I think the fact that we just all three spoke, you know, Josh, you spoke, myself, and Dr. Bajani, the point is it's multidisciplinary. So no concussion really is maybe managed by one particular discipline. It really, effective concussion management is having multiple specialties involved, because concussion is complex, and there may be the medical component, like you mentioned, the medication management. There may be a psychological component. There may be the exercise piece. There may just be the education that the family needs about what is the background of this particular athlete and how might we expect that they go through the recovery process. So we definitely do a better service to the athlete when we're all involved.
So let's go one step further. Dr. Bajani, you brought up a really interesting scenario. Let's say that you have a concussion. It's a high school kid. This high school kid is being treated for attention deficit, for maybe anxiety, something like that. And this is a situation where, obviously, you just said it's referred to Dr. Ott. She's going to go through some more extensive testing, and that maybe there needs to be a manipulation of some medicines. At that point, is she going to go back and have a conversation with you to manipulate some medicines, or is that another conversation with another specialist?
It actually depends. I mean, it's a conversation that will be had based on who's taking care of the meds. You know, if it's a patient, if it's going to a psychiatrist, I can trust, I can make that phone call and start, you know, teasing it out and say, you know, we might up or down the dose of the medication just to make sure that, you know, we get them through this part, and then we'll bring it back up. If the psychiatrist wants to see them in the office, you know, we will by all means facilitate that appointment, and we'll make sure that that appointment gets made in a timely manner due to the acute nature of the concussion. And the recovery process is pretty, you know, very stringent and very prudent. We got to make sure that these kids recover appropriately in a timely manner. If the conversation happens where, you know, I feel comfortable, it's one of my kids that I've taken care of, and just said, hey, you know, we can do this. We'll make the medication adjustments. It's an art. There's no science that truly dictates what you should do with all these medicines. It's more just trying to figure out what makes them recover to an extent where we can get them back to their baseline.
So I have a question for you. So you have these, you've all been at these, seen the different levels. You've seen from middle school football to professional football. And I hate to use football as the only example, but how do you, as an athletic trainer, how do you treat concussion symptoms, or how do you diagnose, or how do you treat the individual differently? Is everybody the same, or do you allow in professional sports a little more leeway, or are you more conservative with the middle schooler? And I guess, Dr. Ott, I'll direct this to you, but how should we as athletic trainers recognize the differences? Are all concussions treated the same by you?
Listen, I'm sorry to interrupt, but for all those listeners, Dr. Johnny just went off and was going to go give a lecture about sports hernia, so we're one-on-one now with Dr. Ott.
This is a really good question, and much of what we do in terms of concussion management is research-driven. So, for example, we have learned that professional athletes, both orthopedically and from a concussion standpoint, recover more quickly than, say, high school athletes. We learned that collegiate athletes are a bit more faster on the recovery trend than high school athletes. So we are more conservative with the younger kids, not only because research has shown it, but we also know that younger athletes have developing brains. So if the brain isn't developed until we think the age of 18, it may be debatable for some people that it's much longer. But for 18, then we maybe want to be more conservative, because there isn't that plasticity that's there that we believed before, that it's more vulnerable to re-injury. And also there could be some other circumstances where the threshold for symptoms isn't there in a younger person that like it is for someone that's older or more seasoned, if you will.
So you'd say that the return to play is the change. It's not I'm going to let you play even as a professional football player. I see some symptoms, but you're going to play. It's more of you're all out of the game, but it's more of a return to play that you're more conservative, would you say?
Right. I would say, the management return to play. We may also elongate the return to play, though, a bit more for a younger kiddo that's, say, age 6, because we see those people in our clinic, too, than we would somebody that is in the professional level where we may say, okay, 24 hours, as long as you don't have any symptomatology, will progress you. So the idea is definitely the same, but the time frame may be extended somewhat based on age.
So, Dr. Ott, going back to your interaction with the athletic trainers, right, there are a lot of people listening to the show wondering, okay, I can hear what's happening and I understand all the concussion research. From a clinical standpoint, tell us about, from a neuropsychological standpoint, what are some of the key factors that you want some of the athletic trainers to know in diagnosing concussions, managing concussions, when to refer, why to refer, and who to refer to?
Well, I think athletic trainers play a large role in concussion management. They're our first responders. They're the persons that are making quick decisions on the sidelines. You don't want to mess with the athletic trainer. I mean, they definitely know what they're doing in that particular arena. They know their athletes. And I would just say that moving forward, we've seen a long and a great progression in the way that we manage concussion. But moving forward, I'd like to see more athletic trainers also be more confident in that many times because they know their athlete better and they are the person that has to see them day to day, that it's okay to say to maybe a physician or someone else that I don't think they're ready and be comfortable with maybe having that role, because that can be uncomfortable at times to tell someone else that's maybe cleared the athlete that you know or you feel like you have evidence to support the athlete and that it isn't healed.
So being able to take you brought up a great term, right? Being able to take some of that evidence-based practice is what we know it and say, look, based on what I've seen, I understand that you've cleared this athlete to play, but I just don't think that they're prepared to be released.
Correct.
And so along those same lines, what kind of training do you think needs to go into athletic training education to make sure that these new athletic trainers that are coming out that are going to have to stand up to some of these big bad coaches and some of these other people will say, you know, hey, listen, the athlete is out at this time. This is just the way it is.
Well, I would guess that, you know, with any kind of injury that you manage as an athletic trainer comes confidence and experience. So the more that you have under your belt and the more experiences in the good ones that you have, and sometimes even the bad ones that you learn from, will make you more confident as an athletic trainer. So going to these workshops and going to talks like what we have today, where we talk about concussion management and the ways to diagnose and to help someone through the recovery process, is key. I would also say that peer review is helpful. I think many times people are too shy to ask their fellow peers about, hey, here's how I manage this case. Was there something that I did, you know, that I could have done differently, or what did you like about what I did, and kind of talking about those things. Case studies are really the best way to learn is, and I gave one today, this is the most problematic athlete for me, and, I would have loved to have any feedback from somebody that would have said something I missed just to help them. So I think, again, making sure that training never stops is really the most important.
So you're always trying to, refine what it is that you do, sharpen the saw, as they say.
Correct.
I've heard that, and this was, 10 years ago, it was common talk among athletes, do bad on the pretest. Do you still see that, the pre-concussion test? So that way, when you take it with concussion, your scores doesn't look like it decreased, and they actually continue to play. Do you still see that in your experience?
It still happens, but not as frequently as it did before, which is a good thing. That means that we have had the benefit of education and talking to people about, please take this seriously. And I think the more you can tell an athlete that's supposed to help you on the end to get back to play maybe more quickly and safely, that's the way to say it, than kind of guessing about what your scores can be. Maybe that would motivate them to perform well. Plus, we have all kinds of nice little nerdy ways of statistics to look and see when somebody doesn't perform well. So we get to say, hey, this is way worse than somebody with Alzheimer's dementia, and you're actually going to school, and you're somewhat performing and remembering, and you're talking, and you're chatting, and you're texting, and you can do all those things fine. So we have a lot more sophistication in the ways that we can identify people who are also giving suboptimal effort.
Have they ever, this is probably a kind of a dumb question, have they ever looked at test fear on the concussion test, for example, impact? Does that ever come in, or is that kind of a different, since it's not a multiple choice necessarily, do you Do you still see that at all? People get nervous in the computer, or is that not a big deal with the concussion test?
Well, I will disclose that I actually had test anxiety, is what we refer to it as, and mine was more in the math arena. I always did poorly in math and algebra, but there is athletes who do have, and not athletes, but students in general, who have test anxiety, and so part of our interview after we do complete the testing and we talk about their performance is to ask about those things. Was there any environmental issues that interfered with your performance? Do you feel like you're just not a great test taker? Historically, mom and dad, are there some evidence-based things that on the SAT they don't do as well as maybe they do academically? So we get to learn our athlete and find out that there could be some other reasons for their performance that aren't necessarily the concussion.
Okay. Now, off of the testing side, you know, everybody knows the classic sign of concussion. You got a headache, possible memory loss. Is there anything that you've seen that is not a well-known concussion symptom that athletic trainers should look for, or something we've seen recently that maybe is a emerging trend or anything like that that's outside of the common knowledge that you may tell people, you know, watch for this or pay attention to this? Is there anything you've seen lately that's come out that you think?
Well, I will add that one of the things I think that first I'll address before I answer your question is that athletic trainers are really great at distinguishing, I think in many ways, dehydration from concussion. I think that there's been a good emphasis on disentangling those types of syndromes, so that's a good thing. The next thing I would say is take it a bit further, and that we talked about psychological effects today during today's talk, but there are a lot of people that have headaches, that have dizziness, have memory and concentration problems that are due to psychological illness or mental health issues that have nothing to do with the concussion. So really getting in front of your athlete and asking them, you know, give me some more information about this. Let's talk about when it started or how long you've had these things so you all can disentangle where it is so you can get them to the right path or the right specialist.
So you have to weed out the extraneous factors in there on the concussion itself.
Right, just like you're doing with a physical exam for a knee or anything else, you're ruling out what it could be or if it's a strain or if it's something more surgical. I mean, just it'd be the same thing.
So you both are dancing around this topic that, you know, is new in the continuing education world for athletic training, is that you hear a lot of people saying, oh my God, I need 10 hours of evidence-based practice. But really what you're starting to see is that everything really dances around this fundamental principle of, is this evidence-based, or how are we making these decisions? How do we go forward with this? Along those same lines, I have a question for you. So again, you know, bring up the case of a scenario, and we diagnose as a concussion, and now we're on the return to play. And we just distinguished that there's a difference between pro, college, and high school, maybe because of the maturity of the brain, et cetera. Do you have a specific return to play protocol? So when you've cleared that patient to return to play, is it day one, no pads, 25%? You talked about a little bit about physical exertion. When do you start to integrate back collision and contact? When do you start to integrate? They can go 25, 50, 75, 100%.
Well, we definitely do our protocols based on sport as well. So we're going to be much more aggressive with, say, a track person than we would be with a football player or soccer player. So there is a progression at which one goes back. And I feel like it's you know, there's several return to play protocols, but there has been a consensus in that generally the first day is more light aerobic activity, no more than 10 or 15 minutes, maybe 50% of maximal heart rate, very light. We wouldn't have people doing any kind of weight training the first day. It would just be maybe 10 or 15 minutes stationary bike, and that would be it. The next day, we might increase those things to 20 and 30 minutes, depending on how they did the day before, and that might be to incorporate some sport-specific activity that would be non-contact. And then by the third day, we would expect that it would be strenuous physical exertion, more like a practice, but not the contact. So in the case of the soccer player, they may be doing the ball dribbling, they may be scrimmaging, but they would not be taking any headers or get into a position where they would go full up, you know, embody, you know, hit somebody or whatever in soccer. So, and then by the fourth and fifth day, we start implementing some light contact for one day, and then followed by more of a full contact practice. So it's really important to get those contact opportunities in there before a game, which is maybe less controlled, so that you can get, and it gives the athlete some confidence too, that I took some shots here, I took some hits, I encountered some contact and I feel good and the symptoms didn't come back. So making sure people have that and don't use the game as the contact opportunity. Sometimes people want to do that.
And at what point do you start to say, hey, listen, I'm confident with you being able to even return to participation? Is when they're completely clear of symptoms, it's when you know, they're completely clear of symptoms plus 24 hours, plus 48 hours? How do you make that determination?
Well, some people may start exertion if they're having rather slow recovery times, and that's a whole different maybe situation. But not everybody that starts exertion may be completely asymptomatic, but we certainly want them to be completely asymptomatic before they start the light contact components. And if even if they're saying to us that they feel good and they're not reporting any symptoms, if there's still some deviations on their light testing and some cognitive issues, then we would still hold them from doing any contact because we feel at that point that's still a vulnerability for a re-injury. The brain's function has not restored.
You're giving me a kind of a good segue to Mike's question. Is we've all been talking about athletic competition. What about the injured athlete that has a concussion, held out of athletics, but he has a major exam, or he has academic work, which is going to require focus, he's got a lot of studying, and he can't do that. Is there, I've heard of a trend or a possibility that they're going to start talking to things like school nurses and instructors for these individuals. What is your, have you heard about that or any involvement of actually limiting, not necessarily kicking out of the test, but letting others know that this kid has a concussion? He may be a little attention deficit in class because he's having, you know, it's a bright room or anything like that. Is there anything we should be thinking about modifying outside of academic or outside of athletics?
I would say that for me, I'm not on the sidelines with the athletes, so that's probably as athletic trainers, really your bread and butter, and my bread and butter is probably the academic side of things. So looking at the neuropsych testing, listening to the level of symptomatology, and guiding a plan for them for return to learn is what we call it. So we do formulate a plan for each athlete and or student that's not even an athlete. So every person that has a concussion gets the same kind of benefit. And we will say that, you know, if there's some reaction time deficits, we'll say maybe the person needs extra time on their test completion. We may say that they can't take any more than one test in a week because the mental demand's too much and their symptoms are so severe. We may say that the person has to sit in the front of the classroom because they have an attentional problem, and so that helps them be free of distraction. So we come up with a tailored plan, and people need to be symptom-free not only with rest, like with rest and then also physical activity, but also doing the mental types of things in the classroom, such as taking tests without symptoms.
So along those same lines, let's go back to something that I think for the athletic training world was huge. I think it was last week, maybe 2 weeks ago, the National Athletic Trainers Association, the NFL, and the Professional Football Athletic Trainers Association, they all come together and via the help of the White House, they come up with some of these concussion laws, and that they're going to now, the NFL is going to try to put athletic trainers in every, I guess, NFL team-populated city to help the diagnosis of concussions. What are some of the things that you think really needs to go as a part of that sports medicine team? You think every area also needs a neuropsychologist, they also need sports medicine physician training, people? Elaborate a little bit more on that.
Well, it was actually, many people credit maybe the NFL with a lot of the concussion management tools and protocols, but really the NHL was one of the first organized professional groups that really mandated neuropsychological testing, had a multidisciplinary team, so the NFL, I mean, falling behind that. But the point is now at the professional level, we have multiple specialties managing concussions. We have neurological consultants on the team. We have the eyes in the sky, and then in terms of the making sure that if there was something missed that someone didn't see on the sideline, it's called down to the athletic trainer working the sideline. We take them in for formal evaluations on the day of the game to kind of see and really to utilize that stuff to kind of predict some stuff later on in a formal, more standardized approach to where everyone gets those things. So I think that the biggest thing that we should be asking is, can we provide the same level of care for our amateur athletes, our high school and our young types that we can for the professional athletes? And we can. So I think in our program at the Ironman Sports Medicine Concussion Institute, I think I said all that wrong, but all the words got in there somewhere. We do have that multidisciplinary team, and I think it's a good model, modeled after some of these professional teams where we have our team physicians on the sideline identifying concussion, and we have the specialists carry out any kind of needs that there may be.
And so you're a part of a really unique collaboration between Memorial Hermann Ironman Sports Medicine Institute, and UT Physicians, right?
Correct.
And all that is, we've been fortunate enough to affiliate with all those entities, Memorial Hermann Medical Group, Memorial Hermann Sports Medicine Rehab, Memorial Hermann Ironman Sports Medicine Institute, and UT Department of Orthopedics. And we were fortunate enough to incorporate Dr. Ott. Well, she's agreed to teach our psychology class, and she's going to teach all of our graduate athletic trainers exactly about concussion management and use some of her psychology skills and sports psychology skills. What are some of the things, you know, you're going to talk to some of these graduate students in athletic training. What are some of the things that a new grad you think needs to know coming out? You know, obviously, we've all been in practice for a long time. We've learned along the way, but coming right out of the gate, what are just maybe a couple things coming from a neuropsychologist of what they need to know?
I think the most successful athletic trainers that I know, and even people within my field and even physicians, isn't where they went to school, and it wasn't the program that they came from. Nobody ever asked me where I went to school, really, honestly. What it is about relationship building. So, and I think you all would agree, sitting across from me here, that we've been very fortunate in that we can build these relationships, and that's what's really going to make our patients and our students and everyone successful and have good outcomes. So being able to ask questions, being able to take initiative, formulate relationships with people, you know, they may not want to meet with you the first day, they have a lot going on, but keep being persistent, continue to make those meetings with people happen. And it's a give and take, you know, they would expect that you would be there for them and to help them with their program. So I think that for me is the best thing. I mean, it's about personality and relationship building, and the rest sort of comes into place.
Well, if anybody else has any other questions for Dr. Ott, Jasmine, do you have any questions for Dr. Ott?
We actually got a question from Chris Sadock.
Hey, Chris.
He said, what are the major differences between the 2008 and 2012 Zurich consensus statements?
That's a good question. So he must be an athletic trainer. Hi, Chris Shattuck.
Awesome.
So good question. For the most part, they were very similar. I think more recently, there's been less focus on some of the baseline testing as being a mandated sort of effective concussion management, although useful for maybe populations where there is a learning disability, attentional disorder, maybe psychiatric concerns beforehand. But so that was one of the chief differences. Generally, the guidelines in terms of return to play were fairly similar. They talked about the place for medication management, defined concussion more significantly. But for the most part, the second Zurich guideline was to build upon the first Zurich guideline.
So not a whole lot of fundamental differences. They really emphasize just on a few key components, and then ultimately, for what we need to know clinically, it's all about the same.
Generally, yes.
Great question, Chris. Thank you very much. Jasmine, anything else from your way?
Nope, that's it.
I think we can judge the expertise of our guests by the time it took them to get from their lecture to this interview.
Yeah.
And by far, some of
Dr. Ott
took the longest. Everybody else could just walk right in, but Dr. Ott had 15 people.
Dr. Ott has got 15 people. She's got a Sharpie. I'm surprised her
entourage. She's going to talk to them. They're going to make her hug.
I had to stand in line.
So yeah. It was very nice for you to take your time to come.
It's called building relationships.
Yeah, it is. She's incredibly.
Well, she's got some great relationships because she just. I mean, we were just talking, and Jeremy and I kept talking. It's like, well, she was done, I think. And then we're like, well, Josh is out there. He's trying to pull her in.
I'll stand in line just to ask her to come in. Yeah, I'm going to stand in line for 10 minutes just to ask.
She is a recognized expert in the field, so we really appreciate her coming on.
Yeah. Now, Dr. Ott, just real quick, I want you to go back. You did your training at your fellowship training at UPMC, is that right?
Correct, in Pittsburgh.
And there are two pretty well-known neuropsychologists out there, is that right?
Yeah, when I was going through the program, Mark Lovell and Mickey Collins were my supervisors, and both are co-developers of the IMPACT test, which I'm sure is familiar to most. And Mark Lovell's now since moved on to concentrate more on IMPACT and its applications. Mickey Collins still is training fellows in sports neuropsychology and very active in the field of research, and then also consulting to professional sports.
Mickey did a great interview. If you've ever seen, I think it was Outside the Lines, maybe, I don't remember. It was ESPN. I forget what it was, but if you look up, if you Google Second Impact Syndrome, ESPN Second Impact Syndrome, there's a story about a young man, college football player, that had second impact syndrome and all the horrible things he had to go through, and some of the misdiagnosis, and Mickey served as a consultant for that. And, you know, he did an outstanding job.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, Mickey Collins and Mark Lovell really paved the way. I mean, we really should be thankful for them for a lot of the concussion management that we have and the policies we have. They were implementing long before HB 30 or 2038 got implemented in Texas. So we have a lot to learn still from them.
Yeah. Okay, if we go around the table, no other questions. This is Dr. Josh Yellen for the Sports Medicine Broadcast, and I'm sitting with Dr. Mark Knobloch, and thank you very much for talking with Dr. Ott. We really appreciate all of your knowledge and your support of athletic training and our athletic training program, which again you can find at www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT. We're fortunate enough to have Dr. Ott as one of our adjunct professors, and she's going to grace us with a number of incredible statistics and knowledge when we get to that point. Thanks to Pasadena High School
for just off camera.
Thanks to everybody for doing this.